Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm being weird. I'm doing my second video in the Rhino Reads AIG Answers book series. So, this being the second video, naturally this is where I start reading chapter 1. It's a long one, which is probably why I skipped it in the first place, but it does warrant a response, and so here we are. As with the other videos in the series, I will have vocal effects on so that you can audibly tell the difference between Answers in Genesis stuff and my responses. Let's go!
Chapter 1. Is There Really a God? By Ken Ham and Jason Lyle. God, an eternal uncreated being? In our everyday experience, just about everything seems to have a beginning.
That depends very much on what you mean by beginning, because in our everyday experiences, nothing really has a true beginning. Everything is just a rearranging of existing materials. We have had no experiences with anything that has truly begun in this sense.
In fact, the laws of science show that even things which look the same through our lifetime, such as the sun and other stars, are, in reality, running down. The sun is using up its fuel at millions of tons each second. Since the sun cannot last forever, it had to have a beginning. The same can be shown to be true for the entire universe.
I recently watched a debate between William Lane Craig and Sean Carroll. This debate was focused on the Kalam cosmological argument. That's the one where everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist who specializes in quantum mechanics and cosmology. During his debate with Craig, he brought up the fact that just some quick, cursory research on his part yielded about 17 plausible cosmological models that involve a functionally eternal universe, with his model being, to oversimplify it a bit, that we perceive time as a function of entropy, and when we trace the entropy back to the Big Bang, you can go past the Big Bang and see entropy proceeding in the opposite direction on the other side of it, making our local universe essentially eternal, with a reversal of our perceived arrow of time at the midpoint. Point at the Big Bang, and cosmic inflation works to provide many Big Bangs forever and ever. Amen. Now, this is a gross oversimplification. It is a fascinating model, but my point in bringing it up is that there are more than 17 cosmological models that do not terminate at a beginning point. So, no, the idea that the universe had to have a beginning cannot, at this time, be shown to be true.
So when Christians claim that the God of the Bible created all the basic entities of life and the universe, some will ask what seems to be a logical question. Who created God?
Yeah, that is a logical question, because often the justification for needing a God to do the creating is something like information can't spontaneously create itself. It must be created by something with even more information. Therefore, it must have been God. Which then leaves us wondering, if the information had to originate with something that has more information, therefore God created the stuff, then that means that God has more information than the stuff, which means that his information had to originate with something that has more information than him, etc. Yes, people who ask this question are aware that Christians believe God is outside of space-time, whatever that could even mean, and is therefore eternal and doesn't have a creator, but that just seems like special pleading. The rule that information had to come from more information just doesn't apply because he exists in a way that we have never been able to verify.
The very first verse in the Bible declares, "In the beginning, God." There is no attempt in these words to prove the existence of God or imply in any way that God had a beginning. In fact, the Bible makes it clear in many places that God is outside time. He is eternal, with no beginning or end.
Yeah, there it is. Yes, we are all aware that you think God is eternal. Nobody read that and went, "What? He's eternal? Okay then, I guess that perfectly explains why the rules don't apply to him."
Is it logical, though, to accept the existence of such an eternal being?
No. Such an eternal being, if it has the properties that fundamentals like the people at AIG attribute to it, is an internally contradictory being who cannot logically exist.
What would we look for? What evidence would we expect to find if there really is an infinite God who created all things, as the Bible claims? How would we even recognize the hand of such an omnipotent, all-powerful creator?
Well, if he's truly all-powerful, then that depends entirely on what his goals even are. If his goal is to be recognized, then nothing could stop us from recognizing him. If his goal is to remain hidden, then nothing could possibly allow us to find him. Or maybe there's some weird middle ground where he only wants some people to find him. Well, according to Romans 1:20, everybody already knows that God exists, so to me, this sounds like a God who wants everyone to find him. So really, it should be impossible to not notice God's presence. Given how many people can't find God when they earnestly seek him, and the fact that an all-powerful God who wants to be found will be found, this doesn't look good for the God of the Bible.
The Bible claims that God knows all things. He is omniscient. Therefore, he is infinitely intelligent. To recognize his handiwork, one would have to know how to recognize the evidence of the works of his intelligence.
Yeah, but again, you'd first have to understand what his goal was before you could even begin to recognize the works of his intelligence. If his goal was to create everything in a haphazard way that makes it look entirely like it formed naturally, then we wouldn't be able to recognize the sign of his intelligence, because the sign of his intelligence would be in just how perfectly unintelligently designed everything is. If his goal were to make a special place just for humans, then you would expect the place where humans live to be, well, special. And unfortunately for this argument, the more we learn about the universe, the less special our little corner of it appears to be, with the latest estimates of Earth-like planets in the habitable zones of sun-like stars being about 6 billion in our galaxy alone. Our little rock, while special to us, doesn't look all that special in the grand scheme of things. So if there's an all-powerful God that created everything, the way he designed the universe points to his goal being closer to nobody knowing about him rather than him wanting a personal relationship with us.
How do we recognize the evidence of intelligence? Why do scientists become so excited when they discover stone tools together with bones in a cave?
Archaeologists get excited when they find anything related to archaeology. Just the bones in a cave would be exciting all by themselves. Stone tools with the bones is even more stuff, so it's even more exciting.
The stone tools show signs of intelligence.
Not really. It shows signs of tool use, which is an important historical marker for any species that engages in it. We get excited when we see chimps using sticks to fish ants out of their nests. Yes, intelligence is certainly a part of it, but it is more that we're learning about science and history than we are excited just to find signs of intelligence all by itself.
We can recognize design, the evidence of the outworkings of intelligence. We see man-made objects all around us, cars, airplanes, computers, stereos, houses, appliances, and so on.
And how do we know that these objects are man-made? I mean, there is an intuitive, we just know kind of feeling about it, but we want to rely on intuition as little as possible when dealing with science. And what it comes down to is that human activity is the only known mechanism that has caused these things to be built. And so we assume that they are man-made based on previous experience.
In discussing a comparison between a stone and a watch, he concluded that the watch must have had a maker, that there must have existed, at some time and at some place or other, an artificer or artificers who formed it for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use.
Okay, let's hypothetically grant the watchmaker argument, the whole basis of which is that we can intuitively understand the difference between designed objects and non-designed objects. Well, I don't know about Paley, the guy who made the argument originally, but for AIG, they believe that the whole universe is designed, every last subatomic particle of it. In which case, when comparing the rock to the watch, we would have to conclude that they are both designed. But then we lose the comparison between something that is obviously designed and something that is obviously not designed, as everything is, in fact, designed. So, if everything is designed, then how would we even know what a non-designed object would look like to compare it to?
Paley thus believed that, just as the watch implied a watchmaker, so too does design in living things imply a designer.
Maybe, but AIG's God is a God who designed everything, absolutely everything. So why are we restricting the obvious indications of design to living systems? Shouldn't the rock also show definite indication of design? Or did God not design the rock, and so we can compare it to something that he did design to get a good idea of what design looks like? And how do we even know which objects he designed and which he didn't so that we could compare them to the designed objects? Where do you draw the line, and why do you draw it there? Or are you just appealing to intuition?
Although he believed in a God who created all things, his God was a master designer who is now remote from his creation, not the personal God of the Bible.
In other words, since he wrote his watchmaker analogy well before Darwin was even born, we at that time had no knowledge of the natural processes at work that could apparently mimic designed elements, and so design seemed like a more plausible explanation than anything else at the time. Add that to the list of supernatural explanations that have been replaced by natural explanations as science progressed.
Scientists who reject the concept of a creator God agree that all living things exhibit evidence of design.
Yes. Often scientists will talk about nature in ways that appear to be appealing to design. They use language that we are familiar with to describe concepts that we may not be familiar with to make them easier to grasp. Also, a lot of times they will point out that life does appear to be designed if you are only looking at it superficially. Creationists like to take out the "if you are only looking at it superficially" part and then keep the "life does appear to be designed" part. Of course, it is usually more nuanced than that, but creationists just can't seem to help themselves when it comes to jumping on things like this at the expense of the bigger picture. For instance, when I interviewed Brian Wolfmuller, there were a couple of times where he completely derailed the conversation because he wanted to point out that I'd said something like, "if evolution doesn't find a use for something," even though both of us knew through the whole conversation that I do not think that evolution is an intelligent or guided process.
So you used the language just now of, "if evolution doesn't find a use for it," which is, so how would you, but I think that's great, because I mean, because that for me is like, "aha, gotcha, haha." But yeah, I know you don't mean it's anthropomorphizing
it for the sake of brevity.
But making the point that I had used language that seems to imply guidance or intelligence behind it. And if that's how it is talking to a creationist while I was there to actively correct him on my usage of those kinds of terms, then just imagine how much worse it gets when the person on evolution's side isn't there to defend their choice of language.
There is no doubt that even the most ardent atheist concedes that design is evident in the animals and plants that inhabit our planet.
Yes, if you look at it purely superficially, there is an appearance of design. But when you start investigating it, there is just way too much going on, biologically speaking, that doesn't make sense in light of an intelligent design process. From the ears in our heads that still today try to swivel our non-swivelable ears towards sounds, to endogenous retroviruses, to spinal columns that were clearly originally developed for walking on all fours, resulting in a guarantee of lower back pain for anyone who manages to live long enough, and this is nowhere near an exhaustive list, nor have I even left human beings for the sake of this list. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on that doesn't make sense if it were planned out by an intelligent designer. Well, actually, let me just walk that back a step. As I said earlier, it depends entirely on the goals of that designer. If the designer plans on making it look like it wasn't designed, then well done, mission accomplished. But I don't think that's the designer that you're looking for here.
Who or what is the designer then?
Natural and sexual selection, acting on variations which have a number of causes, from mutations to non-mutagenic variations to genetic drift to ERV insertions to symbiogenesis, and probably a few more that I'm forgetting about.
Design obviously implies a designer. To a Christian, the design we see all around us is totally consistent with the Bible's explanation.
Well, not really, because as you just said, you see design all around you, in everything. The main way humans can tell that something was designed is through experience with things that we know are designed. But you're appealing to a comparison between a non-designed thing and life as a way of claiming that life must therefore be designed. Meanwhile, in your worldview, the clearly non-designed thing was actually designed as well. So we have no basis for comparison. Not to mention the fact that we remain completely unaware of the intent of the designer in the first place. So we don't even know whether the appearance of design would actually indicate design in this case, as a creator who was trying to not be found out would not want there to be fingerprints of design on their handiwork.
Dawkins does, however, concede that the more statistically improbable a thing is, the less we can believe that it just happened by blind chance. Superficially, the obvious alternative to chance is an intelligent designer.
This is true. The problem here comes in calculating the statistical improbability of a thing. Our brains just look at something that appears to be incredibly improbable and then conclude that it must not have happened by chance, but by purpose and intent. Because our brains are wired to see intent even when it's not necessarily there. But then, when we look at the actual statistical calculations, they are based on a number of assumptions that just can't be verified at this time. So rather than worry about the statistical likelihood of life forming naturally, why don't we just focus on how it could have happened to see if we can't figure it out? Then, when we have a plausible pathway or two, we can start calculating the odds of that particular pathway happening on a planet like the Earth, of which there are billions, all potentially running similar little chemistry experiments on their own.
Basically, then, Dawkins is doing nothing more than insisting that natural selection and mutations together provide the mechanisms for evolutionary processes.
I mean, there are a few more mechanisms than that, but those are the big ones, yeah.
He believes these processes are non-random and directed. In reality, this is just a sophisticated way of saying that evolution is itself the designer.
Effectively, yes, bearing in mind that evolution does not have a goal that it's set out to accomplish. If anything could be said to be the goal of evolution, it is reproduction. Everything else is secondary. So in the sense that the organisms that, through one of the various mechanisms that I brought up earlier, are better able to reproduce than their competitors, evolution is designing that species of organism to be more like the ones that are more effective at reproduction.
Does natural selection produce design? Life is built on information. A great amount of this information is contained in that molecule of heredity, DNA, which makes up the genes of an organism.
Sorta, kinda. Depends how you're defining information.
Therefore, to argue that natural selection and mutations are the basic mechanism of the evolutionary process, one must show that these processes produce the information responsible for design that is evident in living creatures.
See, now this is where you run into issues with how you're defining information. Because we've seen mutations that create new proteins, we've seen the development of new organs, we've seen new behaviors, we've seen organisms insert their genome into the genome of other organisms, we've seen organisms exchange genetic information with each other directly without having to go through reproduction first, we've seen organisms develop multicellularity as a stably heritable trait, we've seen fish adapt to life on land over the span of one single generation through phenotypic plasticity. Now, did these changes accompany an increase or decrease in genetic information? I would argue both. Some of these were point mutations where a single base pair swaps out. I think I would argue that that one would be an increase of information, as a point mutation, while genetic material quantity-wise remained the same, it increased the functionality of its expression, so that's more information, I think. Some were insertions where new genetic material made new phenotypic stuff. Some were phenotypic plasticity, where the phenotype changed to adapt to the environment without a change to the underlying genotype. And some were deletions, where a removal of a base pair or a sequence resulted in the improvement. So if we are just measuring the quantity of genetic material, we can see which ones are increasing the amount of information, which are decreasing it, and which are neither. But if we're looking just at the pure physical phenotypic expression, then I would say that most of them are fairly obviously an increase in information. And yeah, I have purposely cherry-picked the instances where we have seen increases of information. There are definitely instances where genetic changes don't work out quite as well for the organism, and these beneficial increase in the information changes are definitely in the minority, but the point is they are in fact there.
Anyone who understands basic biology recognizes, of course, as Darwin did, that natural selection is a logical process that one can observe. However, natural selection only operates on the information that is already contained in the genes. It does not produce new information.
So, what about the moments where genetic information is added into the genome, whether it be through insertion, horizontal gene transfer, duplication, or any other method? This is why you need to explain what you mean by information, because I feel like my whole point here would be hand-waved away by pointing out that all the changes that I brought up were changes to the existing structures and genes. Nothing was created brand new out of whole cloth. But that's exactly how it works. It makes small changes, with each change being very simple relative to the previous change. We wouldn't expect a brand new organ to pop up out of nowhere in the span of a couple generations. But a cecal valve being slightly modified in the lizard's intestines to provide a rudimentary fermentation chamber for food? Sure, that's easy. So easy, in fact, that it happened in just a few generations.
Actually, this is consistent with the Bible's account of origins, in that God created distinct kinds of animals and plants, each to reproduce after its own kind.
Nope. Show me where the Bible gives a clear outline on the basics of genetics, then we can talk about how the Bible supports the idea of genetic information never increasing. As long as your book contains a story about a guy breeding striped and spotted sheep by placing sticks in front of them as they mated, you don't get to claim that it's right about anything to do with genetics.
One kind has never been observed to change into a totally different kind with information that previously did not exist.
Well, your caveat there suggests that one kind has indeed been observed to have turned into another kind. It just did so with already existing information. And that's fine. Nothing in evolution says that every change must be accompanied by more information. That is sometimes an option, but the loss of information is fine too. So I'll just go ahead and take this as an admission that a change in kinds has been observed to AIG's satisfaction. They just take issue with the quantity of information involved, all while refusing to define exactly how they quantify information in the first place.
Without intelligent input to increase information, natural selection will not work as a mechanism for evolution.
Only if intelligent input is actually needed to input information. So, is intelligence needed to input information? Well, again, this depends on the definition of information. Professor of microbiology and molecular genetics Christoph Adami defines it as the ability to make predictions with a likelihood better than chance. This does not necessarily mean that there is a thinking being involved, considering the various options and choosing which one is best. It could be as simple as a single-celled organism being able to absorb nutrients more often than it absorbs non-nutritious particles. He also points out that information is context-dependent. Your DNA contains a lot of information, but if you extract it and put it on Mars, then it ceases to be information. Information, in his view, typically flows from the environment to the genome. If the environment changes, then the genetic information that allowed that organism to survive in the old environment can cease to be information in the context of the new environment, and will then cause that organism to die off. With regards to the origin of life, he points out that just a blanket calculation of the odds that the molecules and processes needed for life forming spontaneously return a result that makes it essentially impossible. But different chemicals don't all occur in the same frequency as each other. So, when you apply a probability distribution, it starts to look a whole lot better. And then when you consider that there might be billions of different environments just on the Earth alone, each with its own different probability distribution for different chemicals, it starts to look pretty damn good. To quote him, "If you just look at chemicals, you don't know how much information is in there. You have to have processes that give you information for free, and without those, the mathematics just isn't going to work out. Creating certain types of molecules makes you more likely to create others and biases the probability distribution in a way that makes life less rare. The amount of information you need for free is essentially zero." So, according to a guy who specializes in both information theory and molecular genetics, information absolutely can come from a non-intelligent source, and does so all the time. In addition to that, the beginning of life doesn't need some massive leap of new information in order to happen. But hey, that's a bit mind-bendy, so let's go even simpler. We can both agree that there is information in our DNA. Now, count out 1 second. Do you know what happened in that second? About 23 million of your cells divided. That's 23 million new copies of your DNA. That's a lot of information that was just made with no intelligent input. You did not consciously decide that it was cell division time. It just happened. And it happens 23 million times every second in your body. Yes, that is just copying out already existing information, but when we're quantifying information, a new copy of the same information does count as new information, at least according to people who specialize in information theory like Dr. Adami. I think this may be why creationists don't like to define how they are using the word information, because any actual definition would pin them down in ways that make it clear that creationism is wrong.
Denton confirms this when he states, "It cannot be stressed enough that evolution by natural selection is analogous to problem-solving without any intelligent guidance, without any intelligent input whatsoever."
So, like when Dr. Hanchick and his colleagues demonstrated the ability for decanol droplets to solve a simple maze to get to a food source? Like that? Are you arguing that a decanol droplet has intelligence? The researchers didn't guide it through the maze, it did it all on its own. Problem solving, with no intelligent guidance or input. Seems like it is possible after all.
No activity which involves an intelligent input can possibly be analogous to evolution by natural selection.
Yeah, that's the creationist caveat that a scientist set up the experiment, therefore it doesn't count because the scientist is an intelligent actor. Never mind that this is just a handful of simple chemicals behaving in the same way that they would behave were they just to be found close to each other in nature. Because it was set up by a scientist, it doesn't count. Classic answers in Genesis. Stuff like this doesn't happen because we never observe it. Well, we set up an experiment so that we could observe it, and look, it happened. Yeah, but that doesn't count because it was set up by a scientist. Well, do you want us to observe it or not? You can't complain that we've never observed it, and then when we say yes we have, turn around and complain that our observations don't count because it was in a lab.
Without a way to increase information, natural selection will not work as a mechanism for evolution.
Well, it's a good thing that reproduction is a thing then, because that increases information.
Evolutionists would agree with this, but they believe that mutations somehow provide the new information for natural selection to act upon.
Yes, and as I've pointed out, the definition of information as being the ability to make predictions with a likelihood greater than chance makes it quite obvious that mutations, among other mechanisms, do indeed provide new information for natural selection to act upon.
Can mutations produce new information? Actually, scientists now know that the answer is no. Dr. Lee Spetner, a highly qualified scientist who has taught information and communication theory at Johns Hopkins University, makes this abundantly clear in his scholarly and thoroughly researched book, Not by Chance.
Yes, Lee Spetner, who in his book that you are calling scholarly and thoroughly researched, said about evolution, "It clashed not only with my religious views, but also with my intuition about how the information in living organisms could have developed." This was in the preface. Essentially, this is an admission that he started from a position of wanting the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution to be wrong for religious reasons, and appealing to intuition to back this up. Mark Perak, who was a professor emeritus of mathematics and statistical mechanics, wrote a review of Spetner's scholarly and thoroughly researched book, and ended up not being terribly impressed. It seems a lot of the statistics and probability that Spetner uses were just copied from earlier creationists, much as creationists today are fond of doing. Spetner also puts too much emphasis on randomness, seeming to have entirely missed the point that selection pressures remove randomness from the equation. My point is, Spetner's book was not well received outside of creationist circles, and not because of some anti-creationist bias, but rather because Spetner displayed a propensity for not even knowing the basics of evolutionary theory that he was attempting to disprove.
In this chapter, I'll bring several examples of evolution, particularly mutations, and show that information is not increased. But in all the reading I've done in the life sciences literature, I've never found a mutation that added information.
Well, then he must not have done much reading, because I found several examples without having to look too hard at all.
All point mutations that have been studied on the molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information and not to increase it.
See, now Spetner, with his qualifications, probably did actually define information somehow in his book. Unfortunately, his book doesn't appear to be available in ebook format, so at this time I can only see the quotes that others choose to give. So what exactly his definition of information is will remain a mystery to me for now.
Evolutionary scientists have no way around this conclusion that many scientists, including Dr. Spetner, have now come to.
They don't need a way around it, because it isn't a valid conclusion, and as well-respected as Spetner may be in the fields that he specializes in, like applied physics and classical mechanics, he is not a biologist. When quoting a scientist on why the entire foundation of modern biology is wrong, it would be best if you could at least find someone who specializes in biology. It's not like creationists with legitimate credentials in biology don't exist. I feel like this is a good place to leave it for now. We're about halfway through the chapter, so we're definitely not going to finish this in one go. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Ratatosky, who says, "The bingo card is fun. You should bring it back for more videos." Well, as I was putting it together for that video, that did occur to me. I thought about making it a regular part of my normal videos, but ultimately I decided against it as the time spent on that would take away from other, more important areas of the video. That said, the website that I used to make it would make it really easy to set up as part of a live stream, and since I've been streaming on Thursdays, often with an off-the-cuff response video at the end, I think I could definitely make that part of the live streams in the future. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the mutations that never produce the new information that is my channel. If you'd like to be completely ignored by creationists while still demonstrably existing, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time!